You're not mentally disabled in any way? You're not a psychopath? No?
With more than 100 square miles, Jackson Township holds the distinction of being the third largest town in New Jersey. Its population, which stood at around 37,000 in 1997, had been steadily growing since the 1950s, when the Garden State Parkway unfurled, inviting urbanites to chase their suburban dreams. For those seeking respite from the hustle and bustle of city life, especially from New York City, Jackson Township beckoned with promises of safety and tranquility. It was a place where families could put down roots and thrive. As one Brooklyn native, Robert Monroe, said, "We moved here because when we came looking for homes, we saw nothing but kids playing in the yards and streets." As the population grew, the landscape of Jackson Township changed. Farmland and forest gave way to housing complexes to cater to the growing population. In the 1950s, home construction averaged 100 a year, but that sprung up to 750 a year by the 1970s, and then 1,000 a year by the 1980s. The allure of low crime rates proved to be a magnet for the newcomers. During the decade spanning from 1987 to 1997, the township recorded a mere 2 murders, one of which was committed by a passing drifter. Reflecting on the township's ethos, Mayor Vicky Rickabaugh remarked, "We're a close community. We're united like an extended family." Among the families seeking sanctuary from urban confines was the Werner family, who came from Staten Island. Valerie and Edward Werner lived with their 4 children, 11-year-old Eddie, 9-year-old Kelly, 6-year-old Tommy, and 3-year-old Lauren. On a warm Saturday afternoon, the 27th of September 1997, Eddie Werner left the family's home on a mission. He desperately wanted to win the set of walkie-talkies that was the top prize for selling the most candy and wrapping paper for his school's PTA. Eddie was sure that he was going to win that top prize, and he had been flashing his wad of bills to friends over the previous days. Eddie had managed to collect around $200 so far, but he needed more to ensure that he won that top prize. He had been keeping his money safe in his pocket, out of fear that he could lose it and miss out on those walkie-talkies. While the PTA advises children not to go door to door, and instead sell to their family and friends, most children in the area ignored that advice. It was now the weekend, and Eddie knew that most people would be at home relaxing after their week at work. Eddie got off to a good start, selling candy at several homes in the neighborhood. But when dinner time came, Eddie still hadn't returned home. As darkness began to descend over Jackson Township, Eddie's parents began growing worried. Valerie and Edward went off searching for him around the neighborhood, but Eddie was nowhere to be seen. They fanned out further afield, searching the surrounding neighborhoods, calling out Eddie's name. When they failed to find him, they quickly returned home and called police. Eddie Werner was born on Christmas Day in 1985, marking the beginning of a bustling household for Valerie and Edward Werner. Valerie was a stay-at-home mother, while Edward practiced law. Unfortunately, Eddie's path was marked by challenges from an early age. He was afflicted by a mild form of Tourette's syndrome. This is the condition characterized by involuntary movements and vocalizations, known as tics, and his academic journey bore the weight of his neurological condition. Eddie struggled to navigate the confines of formal education and grappled with the rigors of school life. He eventually needed to repeat the 5th grade at school. Yet amidst these obstacles, Eddie's spirit remained undaunted. He possessed a keen creative streak and an innate friendliness, which helped him to forge connections with those around him. As the eldest of four siblings, Eddie's role within the Werner household was one of both responsibility and companionship. His siblings, Kelly, who was born in 1988, Tommy, who was born in 1991, and Lauren, who was born in 1994, rounded out the family unit. As the family grew, their journey took them from Staten Island to their home off New Prospect Street in Jackson Township, where Eddie quickly became a familiar presence in the neighbourhood. On the afternoons and weekends, Eddie spent his time outside with the other local children, playing hide-and-seek, cops and robbers, or cycling his bike through the familiar streets. Anchored by a steadfast faith, Sundays for the Werner family were spent at the Catholic Church, where they sought spiritual guidance from their pastor, Casimir Lidzinski. Reflecting on Eddie's character, the pastor fondly remarked, "He was a very likable boy. He loved to do push-ups with his father. He was a real lovable kid who would never hurt a fly." After Eddie failed to return home on Saturday, the search for him commenced promptly, with both law enforcement and volunteers combing through the neighbourhood. As it became evident that Eddie hadn't simply wandered off, the search expanded outward. Every conceivable hiding spot, from bins to drains, was meticulously checked, yet Eddie remained elusive. The detective set up a command post roughly half a mile away from Eddie's home and urged the public to report any sightings or suspicious activity. After exhaustively searching the immediate area, attention shifted to the dense woodland nearby. New Prospect Street, where Eddie lived, bordered expansive wooded and marshy terrain, including Woodland Park and Monmouth County Park, both of which were crisscrossed by Snake Creek. Search efforts intensified in these areas, with teams meticulously combing through the undergrowth while police divers scoured the nearby Matatadonk River. As daylight faded, the search persisted into the night, with officers and volunteers tirelessly calling out Eddie's name. Their flashlight beams piercing through the darkness. Early the next morning, sniffer dogs were enlisted to aid in the search, attempting to trace Eddie's scent. Simultaneously, a state police helicopter was deployed, scanning the terrain below with specialized heat detection equipment. Meanwhile, Eddie's parents, Valerie and Edward, remained confined to their home, holding out hope for Eddie's return. Overwhelmed with concern, they received the support of a clergyman, dispatched to provide comfort and solace. One neighbour, Claire Rachick, said of Valerie, "She's just getting more and more crushed, going down, down, down. This is a mother's worst nightmare." The search persisted, and detectives came across a black t-shirt along Aldrich Road near Lake Aldrich, approximately a mile from the family's home. The day that Eddie disappeared, he was dressed very maturely for his age, in a dark t-shirt, dark jeans, and dark shoes. However, when presented with the shirt, Eddie's parents couldn't confirm for sure whether it was his or not. In close proximity to the t-shirt, detectives stumbled upon a knife, adding a concerning dimension to the search for Eddie. Despite the community rallying together in extensive search efforts, Eddie's vanishing cast a shadow of unease over the area. Speculation circulated, with some suggesting that Eddie may have encountered a child predator when he knocked on their door. Another possibility was that he was abducted during his neighbourhood rounds. Yet no concrete evidence emerged, leaving detectives perplexed. It seemed as though Eddie had vanished without a trace, leaving the community haunted by the uncertainty. Parents refused to let their children venture out alone, even just to play in the streets during daylight hours. One local, Mark Falk, commented, "I'm afraid to let them in front of the house now. I never had to worry before." As the search continued through the night once more, a candlelight vigil at Christian Life Church drew a crowd of more than 100 people. They came together to pray for Eddie's safe return. A group of children who were friends with Eddie were there, and some spoke about the rumours that were circulating. James Sinnott commented, "Most of us think he was kidnapped." The search for Eddie pressed on that night. In the quiet of the early morning, at around 1 a.m. on the 30th of December, a police officer, accompanied by his trusty sniffer dog, combed through the wooded area just off Woodland Road. This was around 600 yards away from Eddie's home. With the beam of the officer's flashlight cutting through the darkness, the sniffer dog picked up a scent and led them along a winding trail. This overgrown trail was a shortcut that connected neighbouring housing developments. While the route was convenient, it had earned a notorious reputation as a hideout for local teenagers, a place where they could smoke and drink away from prying eyes. Guided by the dog's instincts, the officer followed to a particular spot where the dog abruptly halted. Illuminated by the officer's beam, a chilling discovery emerged from the shadows. The partially unclothed body of Eddie lay on the ground. Without hesitation, the officer summoned backup, and soon forensic experts descended upon the scene. With meticulous care, they documented and scrutinized every detail before Eddie's body was transported to the medical examiner's office. The autopsy found that Eddie had suffered blunt force trauma to the head, had been sexually assaulted, and then strangled to death. On its back, the pathologist found a footprint. As the community was left reeling from the discovery of Eddie's body, a murder investigation was launched. The news spread throughout the area and further afield, and detectives soon received a phone call from detectives in Suffolk County. They said that the year beforehand, they had been investigating a case involving a man who had sexually abused a teenager after striking up a relationship with him online. The victim in that case was 15-year-old Sam Manzi, and he lived in the neighbourhood beside the wooded area where Eddie's body had been found. Sam Manzi was born to Nicholas and Dolores in California on the 25th of February 1982. The family moved around a lot when he was growing up, from Florida to North Carolina and then over to Jackson Township. They purchased a two-story, white colonial home with a backyard deck and above-ground swimming pool on Woodland Road. Nicholas and Dolores worked hard to provide for Manzi and his older sister, and set up a business organizing bus tours to the Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. Manzi was raised as a Catholic and had attended Catholic schools before settling in to Christian Brothers Academy, a private all-boys school with a focus on Christian education. As Manzi traversed through his teenage years, he came to a profound realization about his sexuality. He was gay. While his peers ventured into the realm of dating girls, Manzi kept to himself, navigating a world where he felt different. The hallways of his school echoed with taunts from bullies, who found amusement in his lack of a girlfriend. Frustration gnawed at him until one day, he came into school with a picture of a girl sourced online and claimed that she was his girlfriend. In the burgeoning era of 1996, with the internet still in its infancy, Manzi's fascination with it grew exponentially. He delved into creating a website dedicated to his favourite band, the Smashing Pumpkins. On this digital platform, he meticulously catalogued his favourite songs, albums, and an extensive collection of memorabilia associated with the band. Yet it wasn't just about content consumption. Manzi stumbled upon the universe of chat rooms, a phenomenon that was gripping the cyber community. Manzi immersed himself in various chat rooms on America Online, including one tailored specifically for fans of the Smashing Pumpkins. But Manzi soon learned firsthand about the dark underbelly of the internet. In his quest for connection and understanding, Manzi ventured into the realms of gay chat rooms. He stumbled upon a particularly ominous one that was named Boys. Manzi was unaware that this chat room was filled with paedophiles, searching for young boys to groom. Among them was 43-year-old Stephen Philip Simmons from Long Island. Simmons had two previous arrests for sexual offences and had been sentenced to 1 to 3 years in prison for a 1984 conviction of sodomy with somebody under the age of 14. Simmons struck up a conversation with Manzi and quickly began grooming him. This continued for months until Simmons proposed a face-to-face meeting. On the 10th of August 1996, Nicholas innocently drove his son to Freehold Raceway Mall, thinking that he was meeting friends. Little did he know Manzi's rendezvous was with Simmons. From there, Simmons drove Manzi to a nearby motel, subjecting him to sexual abuse, which he documented with videos and photographs. In the ensuing months, they met several more times at local motels along US Route 9, and even at Simmons' home. On each occasion, Simmons kept Manzi for a day or two, which resulted in Nicholas and Dolores reporting their son missing. Despite Manzi's claims of being with friends and losing track of time upon his return, Nicholas and Dolores grew increasingly suspicious. In August of 1997, after a year of secrecy, they uncovered Manzi's frequent calls to Long Island. Manzi refused to tell them who he was calling, which resulted in them calling the phone number. When they heard an adult male on the other end of the line, it dawned on them that their son had been groomed. In a bid to intervene, they admitted their son to the Shoreline Behavioural Health Centre, where he underwent sessions with a therapist. While initially reserved, Manzi gradually began to open up. He broke down and revealed the truth of his year-long ordeal. But Manzi's revelations didn't stop there. He disclosed to the therapist that he had been having dark thoughts about harming children. In particular, he said that he often fantasized about killing a little boy. Manzi had told this same fantasy to Simmons, but he had provided even more information. He had confessed to Simmons that not only did he daydream about killing a little boy, he fantasized about raping a little boy as well. It seemed that the abuse victim had evolved a desire to become the abuser. The therapist immediately contacted police and told them what Manzi had told her. Are you that friend who loves to indulge yourself in little luxuries? It's perfectly fine. We all do it from time to time. For instance, perhaps you opt for that nearby fancy coffee shop instead of brewing at home. Or maybe you find yourself buying more during a sale. Well, because it's a form of saving money, right? If these scenarios resonate with you, then why compromise when it comes to your health and finding a doctor? That's where ZocDoc comes in. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated, in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Say goodbye to that awkward wait on hold with a receptionist. Once you've found your preferred doctor, just book them right away. And all of these doctors have verified reviews, and they treat almost every condition under the sun. If I knew about ZocDoc when I was on the hunt for a good doctor a few years ago, my life would have been a million times easier. Just go to ZocDoc.com/morbidology and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That is ZocDoc.com/morbidology. ZocDoc.com/morbidology. Many people are often surprised to discover the diverse audience of older women that tune into Morbidology each week. Today, our sponsor, Winona, caters specifically to this demographic. Designed for women navigating menopause or perimenopause, Winona is a network of OBGYN health professionals dedicated to acknowledging and addressing your symptoms seriously. They provide physician-prescribed bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, also known as HRT, through a user-friendly network of in-state doctors, simplifying the initiation of HRT. Winona's bioidentical HRT employs plant-based hormones, aligning with your body's natural rhythm, to alleviate hot flashes, weight gain, and other symptoms. Remarkably, 80% of Winona's users experience relief within just 90 days. Visit buywinona.com to start your free trial. With free US shipping and the ability to pause or cancel any time, your path to wellness has zero obligations. Use the code Morbidology at buywinona.com for 25% off your first order. That is buywinona.com/morbidology. Manzi cooperated with detectives, providing them with Simmons' name. He allowed his phone to be tapped and pointed out the motels where Simmons had taken him. He had become bait in a sting operation, and during one taped phone call, Simmons could be heard telling Manzi, "I liked you because it was fun to be with you, because I can carry on a conversation with you, because you had a brain. You were very frustrating, but you had a brain. I much prefer somebody who's got a brain to somebody who's got a cute butt." Manzi went along with the conversation, as Simmons told him that he missed him and hoped to see him soon. Manzi said to detectives that the sexual encounters were not consensual, but after a couple of days he had a change of heart. Manzi became uncooperative with detectives and became angry at his parents for trying to have Simmons arrested. He lashed out at them, screaming and shouting before throwing a television remote at them. On another occasion, he set fire to his bedroom and hurt the family dog. Manzi continued seeing social workers and therapists while the investigation continued. He admitted to them that he used ketamine and alcohol. He said that he was sad and lonely and had been suffering from depression and anxiety for some years. He shared that he had been having pedophilic fantasies and even admitted to fondling a child when he was 14 years old. Then on the 22nd of September 1997, things came to a head. Manzi's parents took him to the crisis center at Paul Kimball Hospital for an overnight stay. Just the next day, Manzi called up Simmons and warned him that detectives were investigating him before he smashed the electric monitoring device tracking his phone calls. But detectives already had everything they needed, and Simmons was arrested and charged with sexual assault on the 25th of September. Manzi wasn't happy, and he spun out of control. He became destructive and defiant, and as tensions mounted, Nicholas and Dolores reached a breaking point in the days preceding Eddie's disappearance. They appeared before a family court judge petitioning for their son's placement in a residential psychiatric facility. Their primary concern was curbing Manzi's violent outbursts. During the hearing, Nicholas conveyed their distress, stating, "The relationship in the house between my son and the rest of the family has quickly deteriorated, and we are afraid of Sam." He said that his son was having fits of rage and that he needed a structured environment before adding, "which obviously we haven't been able to provide all these years, or otherwise it would be different now." Nicholas spoke about the sexual abuse of his son and said that he didn't care whether his son was gay. He told the judge, "I want him back as my son. I don't care where he's at with his sexuality or whatever it may be. He's my son and I love him. He just doesn't get that." Two experts had examined Manzi, including his therapist who had been seeing him for a month and another therapist from Kimball Medical Center. The one from the medical center recommended that Manzi be released to his parents, but the therapist disagreed and said that he should be confined. She told the judge about the comments he had made about fantasizing about killing a little boy. Under New Jersey law, for a teenager to be committed, they need to present an imminent danger to themselves or to others. Despite the therapist's concerns, the judge ultimately ruled that Manzi would return home with his parents, just 3 days before Eddie disappeared. The judge then said to Manzi,
"You're not mentally disabled in any way? You're not a psychopath? No? So you have some adjustment problems. That appears to me that you're a fine young man and that the problem that exists in this family unit can be overcome if everybody will take a positive approach, positive attitude. I'm going to make your parents take you home today."
And with that, Sam Manzi returned home with his parents. Upon receiving Manzi's name from detectives in Suffolk County, detectives in Jackson Township paid him a visit. Manzi denied that he had ever seen Eddie, but he was displaying signs of nervousness, something which wasn't missed by detectives. With his mother's approval, detectives brought Manzi to the police station for questioning. Simultaneously, they secured a search warrant for the computer in his bedroom. When it was searched, they found collections of child sexual abuse images. Detectives then searched Manzi's bedroom, discovering a pair of sneakers matching the footprint found on Eddie's back. Over at the police station, Dolores was granted a private conversation with her son. Confronted with the unsettling findings from his bedroom, she implored him to tell her the truth. Meeting her gaze, Manzi said, "I wasn't hurting that little boy. I was killing my psychiatrist, killing him over and over." He then added, "Because I told him I was going to hurt somebody, and he didn't do nothing about it." On the day that Eddie disappeared, Manzi had found himself home alone. While outside smoking a cigarette, Eddie struck up a conversation with him and offered to sell him some candy. Although Manzi experienced a rush in Eddie's presence, he initially declined the offer. Manzi then went back inside and called up a girl named Mary, an acquaintance from Shoreline Behavioural Health Centre. They chatted for several moments before Manzi abruptly ended the call and caught up with Eddie down the street. Claiming a change of heart, Manzi invited Eddie inside to purchase some candy. Once inside, Manzi swiftly locked the door behind them. He then turned to Eddie and said, "You're going to die." Despite Eddie's pleas to go home, Manzi forced him upstairs and into his bedroom. He put on some loud music and attempted to try and calm Eddie down by telling him that he could play a video game on the computer. But Eddie was far too terrified even to move. According to Manzi, he didn't necessarily want to kill Eddie. He only wanted to molest him. But he knew that if Eddie left alive, he would tell his parents what had happened. After a couple of moments alone in the bedroom, Manzi sexually assaulted Eddie. He then grabbed an electric alarm clock and used the cord to strangle him as he lay on his stomach. It proved to be much more difficult than Manzi had imagined, and after 40 minutes, he switched the cord to a necktie because his hands were sore. He pushed his foot against Eddie's bare back while strangling him. Only when Manzi believed that Eddie was finally dead, did he finally let go. But Eddie wasn't dead yet. He began to make gurgling sounds, as if he were trying to catch his breath. So Manzi hit him over the head several times with the clock. Afterwards, Manzi put Eddie's body in a suitcase and left it outside. At around 3 a.m, when everybody was asleep, Manzi hauled the suitcase over to the woods near his home and emptied Eddie's body out. Just the day after Eddie's body was found, Manzi was charged with murder and aggravated sexual assault. However, prosecutors hadn't yet decided whether to charge him as a juvenile or an adult. They had 30 days to make that decision, and in the meantime, Manzi was to be held in a juvenile detention centre. As the decision was being made, the community rallied together to honour Eddie's memory with a heartfelt service. Converging at the auditorium of Jackson Memorial High School, they stood united, offering solace to Eddie's family and paying tributes. Leading the service, Reverend Tom Jeffrey addressed the gathering, acknowledging the widespread grief, enveloping not just the community but the world at large. From distant corners like Japan, condolences had poured in, a testament to Eddie's impact. Reverend Jeffrey's words resonated deeply as he spoke. "We come before you, hurting, broken, confused," drawing the congregation into a shared sense of mourning. Amidst the service, a poignant moment arose as the assembly stood up, clasping hands in solidarity and offering collective prayers to the Werner family. Then on the 4th of October, Eddie was laid to rest, drawing a crowd of around 600 mourners to his funeral mass. With his closed casket positioned prominently at the church's forefront, Valerie and Edward, accompanied by their daughter Kelly, found their seats amidst the sea of grieving faces. In the solemn ambience, there were no eulogies delivered. Instead, the church's pastor, the sole speaker, recounted Eddie's recent involvement in the religious education program. Reflecting on Eddie's baptism, he said, "God made a promise that Eddie would live forever. We say God, be God, and take care of Eddie forever." Outside of the church, some people spoke with the media about Eddie, but also about Sam Manzi. The details of his sexual abuse had already made headlines, and a lot of people had their own thoughts. One woman, Linda Girada, said, "It's not an excuse. I don't care what your problem is, but it explains it, I guess." So the point added, "It doesn't change anything as far as I'm concerned." Just the day after Eddie was laid to rest, prosecutor David Millard filed a motion asking that Manzi be tried in an adult court. He announced, "Due to the heinous nature of the crimes against Edward Werner, there is a need for deterrence both as to this defendant individually and general deterrence to dissuade others in society, including juveniles, from committing such horrible acts of violence. Manzi's defence attorney, Michael Critchie, responded by saying that he would fight their request and launch an insanity defence. He portrayed Manzi as the victim of sexual abuse, who fell apart when he was used as bait to catch Simmons. He stated, "Here he was, a victim of sexual abuse who was being medicated and treated by a psychiatrist. And he was simultaneously being used in a sting operation, in an undercover capacity, all at the age of 15. Defense attorney Critchley said that the system had failed Manzi by not having him committed to a psychiatric facility in the days before he killed Eddie. Once details about the sting operation to catch Simmons became public, the prosecution and detectives came under fire. It was virtually unheard of for a teenager to be used as bait in such cases, and some questioned whether this had caused Manzi to lash out against Eddie." Simmons had his own thoughts on the case, telling the New York Post from jail, "We're all responsible. We all had an effect on this, and it's time we all take responsibility. There's a lot of people here who have to examine their own motives and their own methods. There's a lot of villains." Assistant prosecutor Peter Wausau responded to his comments, stating, "His allegations about the responsibility of this office is absurd." Towards the end of October, Judge Robert Fall announced that Manzi would currently be remanded at a juvenile detention centre, where he would continue taking medication. He said that a later hearing would determine whether Manzi was facing an adult court or juvenile court in the upcoming trial. Meanwhile, Eddie's mother, Valerie, spoke with the Philadelphia Daily News. She was upset as she commented, "All I'm hearing is that the Manzis were victims of the system, that Sam Manzi is a victim. This is an animal who murdered my son. The one and only victim here is my son." Eddie's father agreed, adding, "He committed a man-sized crime. He should get a man-sized punishment." They had a stark warning to those who believe that Manzi should be tried as a juvenile. Let him live next door to you. In February of 1998, a judge ruled that Manzi should stand trial as an adult. The judge had reached this decision after a gruesome photograph was discovered in Manzi's bedroom. Detectives had missed it when they searched, but in between pages of a book, Manzi's mother found a photograph of Eddie. He was lying face down on a carpet with a necktie and electrical cord, which was still attached to an alarm clock, around his neck. He was dressed only in boxer shorts, and Manzi had taken the photograph after he was dead. Prosecutor William Cunningham referred to it as a trophy photo of his work. Manzi was then sent back to the Ocean County Juvenile Detention Centre to await the upcoming trial. He was placed on suicide watch after making several attempts at his life. He also refused to eat and take his medication as his mental state deteriorated. The judge warned that if he didn't eat or take his medication, he would be transferred to Ocean County Jail. Then on the 1st of April, Manzi was indicted on more charges. He was charged with murder, 2 counts of felony murder, 3 counts of aggravated sexual assault, 2 counts of aggravated criminal sexual contact, and 1 count each of robbery and theft. The last charge related to the money that Manzi had stolen from Eddie after he killed him. The money he had been saving up for the walkie-talkies. Then the following week, Manzi was transferred out of the juvenile facility to Ocean County Jail. The move came after he was caught fondling a 13-year-old boy. The murder trial was scheduled for April of 1990, but before then the judge announced that Manzi's defence could not plead insanity. Judge Peter Javone said that he had reviewed all of the medical reports, and said that these were all devoid of any indication that Manzi was insane at the time of the murder. Despite this, Manzi's frame of mind was still going to be a central theme in the trial, since the judge allowed the defence to proceed with a mental disease and defect defence. But then in March, Manzi appeared in court and instead pleaded guilty to the murder of Eddie. He appeared calm and collected, as he described strangling Eddie with a cord from an alarm clock for up to 40 minutes. He said that he then stuffed Eddie's body into a suitcase and dragged it into the woods. Manzi made no mention of the sexual assault, because in exchange for his plea, prosecutors dropped the rape and robbery charges. Eddie's family were pleased with the change of plea, with Dolores commenting, "Obviously, sitting in court and dredging up everything would be very difficult. Hard for the kids, the family, and his friends. I'm just glad we don't have to go through that." Manzi's parents, on the other hand, weren't pleased with the plea agreement. They had wanted their son to go to trial, to try and prove that he was not seen at the time of the murder. However, this wasn't something that Manzi himself wanted to do. He told his parents that he was sane, and that he had killed Eddie because he wanted to sexually assault him. His mother Dolores stated, "He needs help, and he's still not getting it. My son went against our wishes, his lawyer's advice, and I thought the court would finally stop it. I thought the court would not allow a 17-year-old boy to plead guilty to murder." Following the guilty plea, Manzi said that he wanted to testify on behalf of Simmons, the man accused of molesting him. He wanted to try and tell the court that their relationship was consensual, seemingly unaware that a child cannot have a consensual relationship with an adult. Simmons responded by saying he didn't want his help on the witness stand. He commented, "This has played on my mind for a year and a half. How can I not feel something about it? I do, in a way. If I never met Sam on the internet, would this have happened?" The following month, Manzi returned to court to be sentenced for the murder of Eddie. The prosecution were seeking a harsh sentence, and told the judge that Eddie was killed simply for rejecting Manzi's sexual advances. They referred to him as a sociopath who was programmed to have sex, rape, and kill. The defence were seeking leniency, and Manzi's parents provided some statements. They blamed psychiatrists and other mental health experts for not listening to them and not locking up their son in the days before the murder. Dolores said to the court, "We were told over and over again that he wasn't violent, that he wouldn't hurt anybody." The prosecution then revealed that Dolores had threatened to kill herself if doctors didn't agree and commit Manzi to full-time care in the lead-up to the murder. Prosecutor William Cunningham accused the family of not actually trying to get help for Manzi, but instead said that they just wanted to get rid of him. Dolores had an outburst and screamed, "Take him for a week and tell me you'd be able to handle it. I couldn't handle my child anymore, at least I admit it." She needed to be escorted out of the courtroom. Manzi was then allowed to provide a statement, and it was the first public statement he had made since his arrest. He stated, "I'm sorry for all of the suffering I've put so many people through. This isn't the way things should work out. I still can't figure out why I did what I did." The judge then sentenced Sam Manzi to 70 years in prison and ordered him to serve at least 59 and a half years. Manzi was sent to state prison, but in July he was expected back at court. He was to be called as a prosecution witness in Simmons' trial, but he refused. His refusal meant that he was found in contempt of court and sentenced to 6 more months in prison. His father, Nicholas, said, "It hurts to know Sam is still controlled by this paedophile. His abuse is continuing forward, even until today." Manzi didn't actually need to testify, as Simmons had already made a full confession upon his arrest. Nevertheless, the judge threw out 2 counts of sexual assault, 2 counts of criminal sexual contact, and 3 counts of child endangerment. The dismissal meant that Simmons was only facing 1 charge each of child endangerment and criminal sexual contact, which are 3rd- and 4th-degree crimes. Simmons then changed his plea to guilty, and Manzi appeared in court for his sentencing. He pleaded with the judge for leniency, insisting that their relationship was consensual. Simmons was then sentenced to a maximum of 5 years in prison and has since been released. Edward and Valerie subsequently filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Nicholas and Dolores. However, they eventually abandoned the lawsuit and said that they had come to peace with Manzi's parents. Their reconciliation had come with the help of a pastor, and on the 28th of September 1999, they hugged one another outside the pastor's home. Valerie said to the media, "Maybe now we can begin to start healing and put the pieces of our families back together." Then in November of 2000, a state appeal court cut Manzi's mandatory prison sentence to 30 years. The following year, it was cut even further. That means that Sam Manzi will become eligible for parole in 2027. In the cycle of abuse, the victim can sometimes become the perpetrator, perpetuating the cycle of harm onto others. This tragic transformation often stems from unresolved trauma, distorted perceptions of power and control, and a lack of healthy coping mechanisms. Sam Manzi was a disaster waiting to happen, and despite his parents' attempts, nobody took heed to all of the warning signs. In the end, it was an innocent little boy who paid the ultimate price. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporter up on Patreon, Carly. You can join Morbidology on Patreon for as little as $1 a month, and there are absolutely no obligations. You can cancel your subscription at any time. I upload ad-free and early release episodes, bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus, behind the scenes, which includes bonus audio and videos, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card along with some cool merch. If you'd like to support the show in another way, please, please, please consider leaving me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are a super easy way to support a show that you like, and I genuinely do appreciate the feedback. Morbidology has a private Facebook group, and I'd love for you all to join and share your thoughts on this case. What do you think of Sam Manzi's sentence? Was it too lenient? Too harsh? I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this case. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.